You're listening to the Product Podcast by Product School.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Carlos. Thank you, Product School, for having me here tonight. And thank you, everyone here, for coming out on a Thursday night. I hope that by the end of this evening, you'll be able to walk away with some useful nuggets of wisdom to take back to your teams. Can I just get a raise of hands? Look, how many people here are product managers right now? Okay, so we have current product managers. What about people who are aspiring product managers? Okay. Any engineers in the audience? Okay, cool. So my name's Carly. I am a software engineer at Slack, and my goal here tonight is to empower you with in sharing some of the challenges and experiences my teams and I have had developing Slack over the last 2.5 years, to empower you to lead the most efficient, smooth, and on-time product development cycles in any environment. But tonight I'm going to be focusing on what it's like to develop products in a hyper-growth environment like Slack. So a little bit about my background. I've been working at Slack as a software engineer for the last 2.5 years. I started at Slack in October 2015, just as Slack was emerging as the fastest growing startup. I think we were about 200 people at that time. A year later, we were pushing 1,000 people. It was a wild ride. And during that time, I've had the opportunity to work on several cross-functional teams. I've been a feature lead on our international billing systems. I built out our sales tax and Dunning systems and have worked on our internationalization. All of these have been very deadline-driven projects with several different PMs. I've worked with PMs from different backgrounds, different styles, and different levels of experience. And, you know, it was developing the enterprise product. We've made a lot of mistakes, and I'm hoping that by the end of tonight, in sharing some of the lessons we learned, you'll be able to skip some of that. First, I'm just going to talk a little bit about what makes hyper-growth environments unique, and then tie that into some of the common challenges that everybody faces when they're building software, and how that gets exacerbated in a hyper-growth environment. I'm going to talk about one particular project that happened over the summer when Slack was really, particularly the enterprise team, was, I think, at peak chaos, and we made a lot of pretty much every mistake you could make. Still put the product out on time, but there were a lot of things that could have gone better. And in sharing some of those insights, I want to emphasize the importance and the ways that you can improve your product specs so that you don't have the problems that we experienced. I'll talk a little bit about how we applied some of those lessons to our most recent project, we'll take it from there. So what is hypergrowth? TLDR, in the last decade, we've seen a lot of startups like Facebook and Twitter grow at unprecedented rates. And I won't read this off to you, but this is how the World Economic Forum likes to define it. How many people here use Slack at work? Okay, everybody. Does anyone not know what Slack is? Okay, but I'm going to skip over these last two slides because y'all know this. So I'm going to talk about Slack's hypergrowth. So Slack was founded in 2014. When they started, they had about 16,000 active users. By the end of the year, they had 200,000, I think it was 285,000 active users with 73,000 paid users. That is a 1,680% growth, increase in growth. And by the end of 2014, Slack was valued at $1.2 billion. By the end of 2015, Slack grew to, we had 1 million daily active users with 300,000K paid seats, which is a 250% increase in growth for daily active users and a 310% increase in paid seats. By the end of 2016, we again doubled to 2 million daily active users and 675,000 paid seats. So that's 100% growth, 125% in paid. And as of right now, we have about 6 million daily active users with 9 million weekly active users. 55% of those are outside of the U.S., and we average about 2.5 hours of daily active user engagement. I think I included this tweet from Mark Andreessen. I don't think I just pronounced his name, Andreessen. He was saying that he'd never seen a viral enterprise take off before, and all of it was by word of mouth. They did very little marketing in their first few years. They were the first, the fastest company to reach 100 million ARR right out of the gate. We also were the fastest to reach both 1 million or 1 billion and 2 billion in valuation. Which, as I was researching this project, I found a lot of information about the business side of a hypergrowth environment, a lot of stats, but I was surprised that there isn't a ton on the internet about what it's like to be an employee. This is what it feels like. So some common challenges, I think that most software companies experience these challenges, but in an environment like Slack, it's majorly expedited. When I joined Slack, we had an enterprise product. I joined the enterprise team, and the enterprise product was really just an idea. We had, I think at the time, Slack couldn't handle more than 4,000 users. So any company that was larger than 4,000 people couldn't use Slack without it being extremely slow. And we had companies like Adobe who had hundreds of Slack teams. And we needed a solution to really capitalize on this incredible opportunity for growth. What happens is, when you're growing that fast, you have a lot of new people all the time. And what happens is that you have a lot of very smart people, but it's hard to scale the knowledge. Like, pretty much everyone's a beginner. And that has, there's, like, when I first started, there wasn't a lot of documentation about how anything worked. It was sort of our best practices and the way we, and even just the way that we tracked projects was constantly changing. This has, I'll get into some of the effects of this a little later. There's also the issue of scaling management. So when you have tons of people joining a team, like we had, 30 people every week joining Slack. And what happens, especially when you have a department like the enterprise team, where, we're really growing faster than most of the other departments at Slack, sometimes engineers will get bumped into management roles because it's just hard to find good managers. And that has its strengths and weaknesses, because the skills that you need to be a manager are very different from what make you a really great coder. You also end up losing those really good coders to management roles. And you just have a lot of projects coming in. When we launched the enterprise product, we really didn't know what we were really learning as we went. Is anybody familiar with Enterprise Grid? I don't know if you work at companies where you're using it. So what Enterprise Grid did is it's basically an umbrella Slack that has a lot of administrative features to make it easy to scale to like onboard massive amounts of employees. And the thing about we found when we deployed and started selling the enterprise product to large organizations is that no company uses Slack the same way. And we're not very prescriptive about the way that, you know, you're supposed to use Slack. But as we were getting feedback from our beta users and whatnot, there was just a constant stream of feature requests. And, you know, you have feature requests, people who are brand new managers, loss of really good coders to management. And you could see how things could get messy pretty quickly. And one of the hardest parts is really keeping your systems of communication, like having them catch up with the growth of your team. So you have like, you know, you'll put a system in place and it'll work for a couple weeks, and then you'll realize that it's not, you need to change your system again to accommodate for having more people and more eyes on the conversation and giving people, making sure things stay transparent so that everybody has the information they need to get their work done. And you know, it's really easy to make assumptions. There have been, because also people are new, like you, for older employees, like employees that have been there longer, you know, you get comfortable with who you know, but you can't let yourself get complacent. You have to be constantly like really getting out of your comfort zone and making sure that you know who the new like engineering manager that just got hired is, and that you're constantly like staying on top of who's supposed to own what. And the other thing that happens is that because you're growing so fast and resources are constrained, engineers have to go outside their area of expertise. A lot of times, like when we were working on Slack, I was, you know, over the summer feature leading two projects at once. I had an intern. I was working in a part of the code base that I was not familiar with at all. And it's just sort of par for the course. You have to kind of be willing to like hit the ground running but it does end up slowing things down. So the other thing that happens with hypergrowth startups is code base compromises, which I think is something that is hard for product managers to really get a tangible sense of when you're working with your designers and engineers trying to figure out implementations that are really going to, you know, be like make your customers happy, but also that aren't going to take a ton of time. And what happens is you can either spend a lot of time engineering for massive growth, or you kind of bite the bullet and say, okay, well, we're just going to chase this opportunity and be okay that things are going to get messy. There's going to be a lot of inconsistencies. And this is how I would describe Slack. Like most of Slack was built in 4 months. I don't know how many people are familiar, but the Slack founders were trying to found a game called Glitch. When that was going under, they did an infamous pivot. Most of Slack was built in 4 months. And, you know, those patterns that they built into the code base are baked in. And there was an assumption that, you know, there would always be like one team to one user. And this concept of teams being what tied everything together. And when we got to enterprise, where we have, you know, we have everybody's part of this one enterprise organization, but they can be part of many different workspaces. And so architecturally, there were some major decisions and trade-offs that had to be made by the engineers, which affected how fast we were able to develop products. And also, you know, I remember the first year we were working on it, we had this concept of shared channels, which was just an idea. Nobody, I think that the shared channels, the shared channels details were, sorry. Shared channels was something that, because we didn't have a standardized way of sharing information, and you know, some people were storing things in Google Drive, some things were storing things in like Hackpad, some people were storing things in Trello, some people were doing Jira, it was hard to know where to get the right information or the most up-to-date information. And I think that had an impact also on the decisions made, and it slowed things down. Now I want to take a moment, and I know that a few people here, I don't know how many people here are product school students, but you know, what makes a successful PM? Anybody? Good communicator.
Prioritization.
Hold the vision and execute on it.
Say that again?
Holding the vision up for the product and executing on the details.
Holding the vision of the product and executing on the details. All great answers. So I did some studying on, I don't know how many of you have read the product book, but it's written by Carlos, the CEO, and I'm guessing they use it as part of the curriculum here. And the way that they lay it out in the book is that you have sort of five stages. You know, you're finding the right opportunity, you design for the solution, and then you build the solution, which is the, that's really the part you're spending a lot of your time in. This is when you're working with the engineers. The product spec is done and the code is starting to be written. And the more time goes on, the less easy it is to go back and reel things in. And you really have like limited soft power during this time. So the rest of my presentation, I really want to emphasize the ways that you can optimize this, your power in this process, and how, and ways that you can take, or steps that you can take to improve your product specs and improve your communication so that you can avoid most of the problems that that people face. I found when I was researching this, there's a really great website called, I think it's like Silicon Valley Product, it's called like SVPG.com, and they had this great blog post about the top 10 reasons for slow velocity. And I'm not going to read it all off for you, but these are, when I was reading through these, I was like, oh my God, yeah, these are like, I've experienced this, this all happened. And I think as a PM, you don't have that much control over, you know, and especially in a hypergrowth environment like Slack, where you have, you know, the teams are growing really fast. There's a lack of managers. There's a lack of resources. There's an influx of products being requested. You know, you don't have control over how many engineers you get necessarily, and you also don't really get control over like the decisions made by the engineers who wrote the code. That architecture that's in place is always going to be kind of a roadblock that you have to make trade-offs with as a product manager. And in a hyper-growth environment, you're chasing an opportunity. So time matters, and you want to be able to ship things quickly. But I would argue that most of these other things, you as a product manager, before the code even starts, if you plan and you are like over-organized, you can avoid most of the causes of scope creep and slow velocity. One of the things is lack of strong. So I'm gonna keep going for MDM. So over the summer, I was staffed on a project. We were implementing mobile device management for Slack's enterprise product, and it was the team was cross-functional. We were working with back-end developers, we had a front-end developer, we had iOS, Android, and initially there were two, I'm a back-end developer at Slack, and initially there were two senior back-end developers on this project, and turned out that they were needed elsewhere. So they decided to just give it to me. And I was relatively junior. This was like my biggest project that I'd worked on that was outside the billing code base. And another thing that happened with my team was we had a lack of management resources. So really one of our best engineers was promoted to a manager, brand new manager. His first time managing a big project, not as an engineer. We also had a new PM who had been promoted, which is, again, you know, there's a lot of opportunity to take on challenges in this environment because there's such a demand to get things done. But bottom line, everyone was new at what they were doing, and we made a lot of classic mistakes. I'm going to go back here because I think this is a lot of the mistakes were all of these here. One of the things that I think my, like our novice PM really was trying to embrace this sort of like move fast and break things, agile development process. And, you know, I think that in doing that, that can work, but in a hyper-growth environment, you do need some sort of framework to keep everybody focused. And bringing in the engineer, either the tech lead or the design lead as early as possible can help you avoid a lot of scope creep. Like we had a scenario where, you know, something that was supposed to be a 2-week project ended up becoming a 3-month project. And, you know, we had major accounts that were waiting to sign like millions of dollars on the table to get this one feature out. And so there also wasn't a lot of room for mistakes. And it's a security feature. So things had to be right. And, you know, we really didn't have any of these things. I remember our PM brought me and the other engineer in and was like, you know, I want this to be an engineering-driven project. We're like, tell me your ideas. Like, what about this idea? What about this idea? The thing about design, like, if you don't have the design, engineers aren't designers. And if you don't have a real designer who's there for the user experience, you either have to do that work or, and I think that you really shouldn't bring in the engineers until you know what you want to build, because every option, every design decision may have a different outcome. And it takes a lot of time as an engineer, especially when you're new to the part of the code base, which in hypergrowth environments tends to happen. Like for me, I was on this project, I was in a new part of the code. Every design suggestion or idea was a significant amount of time for me to research, because you have to be thorough. You have to, you know, be bringing up all the edge cases. You have to highlight the details, and also be able to confidently go to your PM and be like, I don't think this is the right option. Because you're trying to make the simplest project for, or the simplest product for your customers that is still high quality. And so we ended up having, a lot of confusing bugs too. And I attribute a lot of our issues to an incomplete product spec. It was things like feature flags. We had 3 feature flags. I didn't find out that we had more than 1 feature flag until we were testing the product. And thankfully all of the iOS code was behind a separate feature flag, but it was totally confusing why something was working on our dev environment but not on our production environment. And it was things that, with more planning, more organization, and really calling things out in the product spec, could have been avoided. And we made all the mistakes. But I think about moving fast and breaking things. As a product manager, like, if you're studying hypergrowth environments, like, one size doesn't fit all. I think, you know, Facebook is a great, like, moving fast and breaking things works for Facebook. Like, they can afford that style of development. But a company like Slack, we still have to move fast, but we cannot break Slack. Like, especially now that we have enterprise customers, it is so expensive. Like, it can cost IBM millions of dollars if we go down for an hour. And that's just unacceptable. Like, we cannot break things. So, and as a product manager, it's even more important to be working so closely with your designers and your engineers from the get-go, so that you can work together to find the most efficient solution and the most efficient version of your product that you can ship quickly, but also accurately. And the way to do that is to organize like your life depends on it. How many people here consider themselves to be super organized people? Okay, we've got a few. If you're going to be a PM, like, this needs to be in a hypergrowth environment. Your life will be so much easier if you develop systems to manage the details. Because really, in the beginning of a project, this is when you have your most of your influence. If anyone's read the product book, one of the things they say about being a good PM and like just the nature of being a PM is that you operate through soft influence. You really can't tell people what to do. You don't want to be going to your engineers and being like, hey, this is how you should implement this. Like, it's just not. And same with, like, that's either the engineering manager or, you know, and technically it's not your job to be the project manager and be on top of scheduling, but you need to, like, really clarify who's owning those processes, because the other thing is I think in a lot of books and a lot of literature about becoming a product manager, there's an assumption that there's some kind of stability in your team and that, like, the roles are defined. Like, you're the project manager and you have you're the product manager and you have a project manager who's going to, you know, implement the scheduling, and you have an engineering manager who's going to, you know, be dealing with the engineers. But there's so much where most of the time, and especially in what we had at Slack, was that just wasn't the case, but it wasn't explicitly called out. So people weren't things were falling through the cracks because in the very beginning, we weren't explicitly stating like, hey, you know, Carly's going to own this part of these couple user stories. Jessica's going to own the rollout process. These are the feature flags. And really making sure that everyone's following up. And so I want to highlight a couple of ways that I think that people can really strengthen writing product specs. And I think it's so silly because it's like, for most, the way it plays out is it's like, it's a Google Doc. And it's like, how does this Google Doc become so vital to how a product gets, how it ends up rolling out. But I really think that you can utilize and this document as a way to, it's something that lives. I'm not advocating for a waterfall dictating product spec. And I was assuming that most of the people here were going to be students of product school, so I was going to skip over this slide. But one in chapter 5 of the product book, they sort of outline, what a product spec is supposed to be. You know, it's supposed to clearly explain why you're doing this project. It's going to address internal goals, external goals. The user stories are going to outline what the functionality is. And I think I don't want to tell you something that you already know, but I would like to emphasize that like these are all essential for your product spec, but they're not enough, especially in a hypergrowth environment. And again, I want to emphasize that like I'm not advocating, like I think that in a lot of ways that Agile's a really effective and important approach. And I think that as product managers like to embrace that, kind of like it's a little sexier than the more military style waterfall product development cycle. But it can come into conflict with your engineers because it's sort of the opposite philosophy. Like as an engineer, you want to think deeply about things. You need to be steeped in the details. You need to, you want to be considering all of the different options before you make a decision, which is the opposite of Agile. Like Agile's sort of like, all right, let's like just like move fast and break this and have something out in a sprint. And I think you need a mixture of both. And your product spec should really be something that is the thing that's bringing your team together. It's your platform for collaboration. It's something that should be living and breathing and changing over the course of the project. I know we can maybe come back to that slide a little later, but I think the key themes for me are leadership, storytelling, and over-organizing. Leadership in the beginning, you want to lead in person, but you also want to lead on paper. You want to be explicitly calling out who's owning what the feature flags are, when you're going to meet, when, like, every little detail that you can should be in one place so that everyone can find it. And I know that sounds so obvious, but it's so easy to lose track of. And I think that collaborating with tech and design leads early and often, and really making sure that you... So one of the reasons that's so important is because you need to be finding the details from them. And sometimes you don't know what questions to ask. And the sooner you're working with those people, the more you can pull out those details from them, like the feature flag example. This is the other thing. user stories. I think that one, at least in the product book, the example of user stories that they give, you know, your user story is where you're outlining the features of your project. It doesn't have to be exact, it doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be detailed enough that your engineer can take that story and break it into engineering tasks. So really, I think it's very important that these are in full sentences, in my opinion, because you want to be, it needs to be readable in a concise way, but it also doesn't need to be a novel. You need to be mindful of who your audience is. Like these user stories and are a vital part of your product spec because they're going to be what your tech lead uses to create the tech spec and what the designers are going to use to make their designs. And the more detailed you can make these, the less likely it's going to be that you're going to have things like scope creep. And, you know, you also don't want to waste time with people asking you basic questions. And it's an art. Like, I think it's an art form. It's something that, you know, takes some time. But I think the more that you can think about these stories are units of work. And the more that you can track, like, whatever you're using to track your projects, whether it's Jira or Trello or whatever people are using, Fabricator, being able to connect like small chunks of work to engineering tasks will just give you more control over and the ability to really have visibility over how the project's actually going. Because once the code starts being written, you don't really have like the product managers are at the whims of the engineers telling them, this is going longer than the plan, sorry. Like, and you know, you're responsible for communicating how this project is going to your superiors. And, you know, I know at Slack, like for the product managers and the engineering managers, like for every project that we have in flight, it's like once a week, they go to the executives, and it's like, is it on time? Is it not? Okay, that's all you get. So, you know, it's important to your career and also the careers of your team and the perception of your team that you make these feature estimations as accurate as possible. And I can't say it enough, but just whatever you're using to, you know, organize your details, you probably need to be more organized than you think you do. And have it in the beginning of the project. Like, whether it's, you know, setting yourself reminders to follow up with people, like, right before it starts up. And also explicitly state... So one of the stories that I have in mind of something that happened on our team is like in for a smaller feature, we had a product spec and it wasn't the essential and the nice to have features were not clearly defined in the product spec. And as a result, as the engineer, I thought that it was done. I had done all of the project that was required in my interpretation of the product spec. There was one feature, it was the week of where we were supposed to launch, and my PM, we had moved on to a different project, it had been about a month, and I guess neither of us followed up. And there was one part of the feature that was like, oh, no, this is actually a requirement. I didn't call this out enough. And, can we get this shipped? And, we ended up getting it shipped. But I think, things like that, again, there's so many details. There's so many changes happening. There's so many people who are, you know, being added every week that you will save yourself so much stress if you can just have all of the details in one place, like set reminders for yourself and constantly like be revising and letting and facilitating collaboration in your product spec. And you know, MDM, we made all of the mistakes. But we ended up shipping it and on time, but it was super stressful. But one thing, my team and I ended up like really applying a lot of, it was similar team dynamics, same PM, same engineers. And in applying these lessons and improving our product spec and really calling out these details, we were actually able to ship our development code 2 weeks ahead of schedule. It really, like, everything went smoothly. It was, and it was because everybody really knew their role. We were really explicit about who's going to own what. We let the product spec live and be updated, it really was a resource that brought everybody together over. In the same, and it was the same circumstances. We had a very hard deadline, there was a lot of unknowns. But the product spec was so much better, we had no launch bugs, it really just made a huge difference in our ability to thrive as a team. And so my key messages for tonight are really to set clear boundaries of ownership in the beginning. I know that sounds so obvious, but in a hyper-growth environment, it's really not. People's titles are fluid. You often have to take on more responsibility than your job title implies, and you have to be willing to do that. And making as a PM, like, you can be the person that gets everybody on the same page. Also, knowing your team's abilities. One thing I forgot to mention was, I think as a PM, it's hard to know, or it's important to know what kind of engineers you have. Like, if you have a junior engineer on your team, like, you should know that before you start developing. Because, like, in my case, I was definitely more junior for MDM. And that project was understaffed. We should have had more people on it. But I don't think that, like, that was communicated very well. That I would, we needed more engineers. And the other thing about junior engineers is they're still learning they're learning how to write code, but they're also learning how to give feedback and identify edge cases. And part of what the purpose of a product spec is to, is for your engineers to be able to call out, what the edge cases are. Your designers are really optimizing for, the use cases, and engineers are supposed to tell you, what are the maybe unlikely cases that we really need to solve for? And junior engineers might miss those things. So it's really important for you to be communicative with your engineering manager to know, hey, what are these people's experiences? Like, what's their background? What do you see as their strengths? Like, and have those conversations early so that you can provide the support that they need to get the work done. And just getting everyone in the room as soon as possible. Design and engineering, having these conversations early can save you from wasting time. And design ends up influencing the engineering implementation. So the earlier that you can have people in the room together, the faster you'll be able to get a product out, and the faster that you'll be able to, or and the more likely you are to avoid products scope creep in the middle of a project that's deadline driven. And then finally, it's like when you're writing your user stories, they're units of work. You are writing them for engineers to break down into trackable tasks so that you have visibility over really how the project is going and how likely you are to finish on time. And you know, that has a big impact on your career. It has a big impact on the like perception of your team. And I think that in improving these things, and I know it's kind of hard to do this in slides without like an example product spec, but I hope that that's all I have for now. One second. Did I get it? Nope. That also wasn't it. Sorry about that. Last closing wish to you all. This is my favorite quote. Ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Or fail again, fail better. In any environment that you end up working on, you're going to be learning every day. And the more that you can get together and get everybody in the room early and really apply the lessons that you make, the better things are going to go. I really hope that I was able to offer some insights that you'll be able to take back to your team and hopefully learn from some of the mistakes that we made. Yeah, good luck herding your cats. So, thank you. I think we have a little bit of time for questions, if anyone has any. Yes.
I've been a product manager at a lot of really big companies, and I'm about to join a startup because I need help creating processes for the delivery.
Mm-hmm.
But can you talk a little bit about what that was like going from the early ad hoc processes into a more formalized product process? Was that like better just cutting the core or weaning them off slowly? I mean, what worked with it?
So part of the, so I would say it really, it depends on the team. The enterprise product is still streamlining those processes. I just joined the platform team and they have a lot more mature process around like how like the product design phase and like the, you know, how thing Jira processes and whatnot. But I think the difficulty that enterprise has had is that we just have, we're constantly fighting fires. And as a PM, I think it can be hard to get like processes prioritized. And getting everybody on board is really hard because everyone is like needing to like fix something or make sure something's not breaking or build a feature that is going to, you know, that is has millions of dollars pending behind it. So, I mean, I think that the best way to do that, or like the way that I've seen it start to develop is, you know, I think it comes to working with the managers, like really, like as a PM, I think the more that you have strong relationships with the engineering managers and are able to allot time for that, I think that, you know, having someone making a decisive choice about how you're going to track the process, like, people need, there's so much going on that you need direction. And if you're going to go in, if it was me, I probably would appreciate a PM that was going to come in and be like, all right, this is how we're doing it. This is the process. You know, we're willing to take feedback and, you know, adjust it after we try this for a little bit. But I think that people really need, like, discipline and structure. And the more, like, as a PM, you have that power to bring the structure to the team. And I think you shouldn't be afraid of that. Like, I think you should, I know that I've worked with PMs that are better at that, and, like, it makes a world of a difference in how the projects go and how the team feels. Yeah.
You guys don't use any type of, like, design review process or standardized, like, share templates that the product managers have to go and, like, fill out each particular section and then, like, clearly define the use cases, error cases, test cases, and then, like, all the QE test cases.
Yeah. Those things are all, like, things that should happen. what I found is, like, and this is kind of going back to some of the unique problems of the hypergrowth problem. I just switched to the platform team, and they actually have much more mature processes for, you know, having a design phase, having everything spec'd out in Jira. Like, it's much more organized and mature. But with the enterprise team, it's happening. It's just happened slower. And it's mostly because there's just so much work that needs to be done that there's sometimes just not enough time to dedicate to that kind of thing. And it's a trade-off. I 100% agree with you. But, like, again, it's this problem of, like, there are a lot of new people, and people don't know what they're doing, and, you know, these people are learning on the go. But you're absolutely right. Like, and I found that the departments that have grown a little slower have those processes. It's just, like, when you're moving super fast, there's just, like, those kind of processes need to be so flexible, and, you know, you also have people working on multiple projects at once sometimes. So it's my theme of being overly organized is coming from that place of just, like, sometimes the norm just doesn't have time to mature.
First, I want to thank you again. It's so awesome to actually get a presentation from when things are not working great. So much more than when everything just so thank you for that.
Yep.
My question was actually related to that too. For storytelling, for preparing the story, in hypergrowth, do you do things like backlog grooming or story time beforehand, and how much does that help?
That's a great question. So we do grooming. We implemented when I first started at Slack, we didn't really have, like, a structured agile process. Like, we had stand-ups, but we didn't use Jira, we didn't do sprints. Probably about maybe a little over a year ago, we started implementing, like, using Jira and, like, doing more, like, strict Scrum agile methodology. And so we do, like, well, we have weekly sprints, we'll have a planning meeting, and I think that did help us a lot, like, stay organized. I think the more so than the backlog grooming, it's really the user stories and how the specs are written that make a big difference in just, like, how even just, like, the questions people are prompted to ask. And, you know, it's easier said than done, but yeah.
So you're anticipating a period of hypergrowth in 6 months. So it's not hypergrowth now, it's all calm and relaxed. But 6 months is going to go vertical, you know, for a fact. What's the most important thing to do now?
It's a good question.
Get organized.
I think that if you have time to make, like, have, whether it's templates or things that can save people from having to spend time, like, making decisions on how to organize themselves. I think the more that you can anticipate that, the more likely you are to be able to, because you have, when you have so many details flying at you and so many priorities, like, if you can get people to, if you can save their energy for solving the harder problems, then, like, how, and I think when it comes to building processes, like, some people are better at designing those than others. And, you know, I think that sometimes people just want, like, they may not feel like they want to be told what to do. Like, if you told them, like, I like being, like, I don't know if I would say, like, I love being told what to do. Like, but I think that it does give you a lot of freedom when there's a process in place. So if you have the time to decide that, that would be where I would invest. But I think it's also important to note that those processes are going to change as you grow. And you, like, what works when you're, you know, 100 engineers is not going to work when you're 300. And that those changes come up faster than you expect. Like, we were constantly, you know, changing the way that, like, our standards of, like, how we use Slack. But I do think that we've done a good job of adapting those processes to our size, in, like, having just, like, agreed upon conventions about how we're gonna name channels, how you find things in Slack, like how things are namespaced, how and the like. Yes.
I don't know how relevant it is, but I'm just wondering, like, during that hypergrowth period, if there was a lot of burnout, like, you know, just you know, really trying to meet deadlines, and how you guys kind of coped with that, with, you know, switching tasks from time to time, or teams, or, I mean, I'm just curious about,
yeah,
if there's, like, a burnout problem.
So one of the things that happened was, like, Slack's really focused on its culture in the beginning, and one of our cultural values was, like, to work hard and go home, which I think ended up saving people from burnout. But of course, there were still people who were really still working hard and on the weekends and whatnot. And I think a lot of that fell on some of the more senior engineers. But I think that we've had, like, a pretty good amount of, like, or very few people quit over burnout. And I think that comes back to the work hard, go home culture, even though it may not be exact in practice. I think we really didn't have the burnout problem, which was cool. It was a really exciting time. They're constantly, like, people were, you had new people all the time. So it did, in some ways, like, the load would get easier, in terms of, like, how many engineers you had, but the processes maybe we would have outgrown the process, and we need to revisit that and adapt it for a bigger team. Thank you. So I think what you're asking is how the engineers and the product managers communicate to get on the same page in terms of how long something's going to take.
Yeah.
Is that fair? Okay. So I think that, you know, it comes down to the product spec in a lot of ways, how well it's written, and how I think that the best thing that a product manager can do is write their product spec in full sentences, identifying, you know, who the user is, what their problem is, and what the context is, and what's their solution. Like, it doesn't have to be a paragraph. You can hit all those things in one sentence. But the more that you can break it down and be very specific, I think that helps engineers identify questions more, and edge cases, and know what to ask. Because if anything's vague, that's like you are opening yourself up to, like, you might have a good engineer who's experienced, who knows what questions to ask, and, like, and where that ambiguity can lead. Or you might have an engineer who's maybe not a good communicator and makes a bunch of assumptions, and they end up not being the right ones. So I think being specific is really important. And also, again, communicating with your engineering manager to work with the engineers if you don't know what their levels are. Because sometimes, you know, everyone's at a different place, and engineers are really bad at feature estimation. So it's just communicating often and being as specific as possible in your stories. Thank you. So that's a really good question. Just for your question is what do we do to help people define their roles? One of the problems with hypergrowth environments is that processes lag behind the growth. I think that, you know, we could have done a better job having been more prepared and anticipating for that in helping new managers know what their expectations are, because I think that is another problem that's hard to solve for, is like, we didn't have the time or resources to properly train people. And I think that with product managers, that role can change depending on the company, and it isn't very defined. But I think that the more decisive that you can be and by not being afraid to put processes in place and not being afraid to, you know, take on a leadership role and make decisions when it comes to, or like help other people make decisions. Because I think that as like an individual, you don't get to choose what your, like what resources your company is gonna offer you. Like you might be lucky and be at a company where, you know, they have a great management program and they're super organized. But I think when you're joining a startup that's growing really fast, you might have to be prepared for those resources not to be there. I think Slack's catching up, and I think in some, like the enterprise team, they're getting there. I think on the platform team, it's a lot more defined. They have a lot more support in terms of like what the expectations are. But I think like the reality of these environments is that sometimes things aren't going to be defined for you. The expectations aren't going to be defined for you. You are in charge of defining those things. And maybe that's the assumption that I should have called out earlier, because I think there is an assumption that like when you're working for a company, people have defined roles. There's clear expectations. Like, you know what you're supposed to do. But more often than not, like your success, like you, if you can be the kind of person that can identify opportunities to just like step in where nobody else is taking advantage, like I think that the philosophy of like ask for forgiveness, or like don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness, is a really good philosophy to have in a startup environment. Does that answer your question? In some ways, I guess the answer is no, we didn't have good processes, but they're developing. Like, you kind of have to make do. So the question was, how do you deal with product specs that, you know, over the course of time end up getting very bloated and over detailed? I think that again is in the product manager's hands. Like the way that I've seen it mature in an effective way is that, you know, you maybe have, like we'll have, the tech spec will be a separate Google Doc, the design spec will be separate, and maybe like the there may be a separate document for background, because a lot of times, you know, when you're trying to define what the goals are and the importance of, you know, why you're developing this project, I think having that, it is important for the product spec itself to, or whatever document you're using, whether you want to call it a product spec or something else, to have one place that's readable and approachable. Like, I think that's part of the problem you're solving for is people's time is precious, and you, like, need to be concise, and you need to, you are in charge of deciding what's the most important things that people should be able to immediately go to this document and will want to see. And I think that that ends up being deadlines, things like feature flags, the user stories. And if the user stories are, I think that user stories should be units of work. Like, they should be units of work in the sense that different engineers can break them up and take them on. You need to, like, I think that having links to things is a really effective way to do that. But yeah, 20-page product specs, not good for anybody. thank you. So the way that my experience has been is that, you know, we did have a program manager, but he was on a couple teams. So he was like, he would be there at our kickoffs and our retros. And otherwise, I actually ended up doing a lot of our project management. And that's something that happens, is like engineers will just like, you have to step up to do things. Like, I wrote a lot of our Jira tickets and, you know, moved them along and wrote our epics. Like, I you end up sort of helping each other out. And I think the more that you can identify, or like, I think something I could have done better probably is ask for resources earlier, because I think that, you know, one thing that I felt more comfortable with was like, oh, like, I know I can help with this, like reword this user story so that it makes more sense to everybody. Like, I can make this, you know, like, I can break up this task. And I did too much project management. And I think that, that's just another thing that you sort of like trial and error learn, like on the next project of, hey, we need more engineers than this. Like, we, And I guess it sort of ties into, like, in a hypergrowth environment, the resources are so constrained that the more organized that you can be, and the more things you can anticipate, the more people aren't doing things that they shouldn't do, you know? Like, I think that a lot of that could have been avoided had we had, like, a more concise, defined system in place to, and, like, protocols. And it's hard to plan for that. I think that, you know, if there's anything you can take away from this talk, if you find yourself working for a hypergrowth startup, is to really think about, like, always anticipating how you can automate things or take, like, small details out of people's, I guess, mental space.
Cool.